Years ago, when Catherine and I were living in Washington, D.C. and serving a church there, the host of a Washington, D.C. financial radio program called me and asked me to be a guest on his program. I guess he had heard that I was a pastor and my undergraduate degree was in financial planning. And so that's a little bit of an odd combination. And so he asked me to be on his program, and he wanted to talk about, you know, financial planning, and in particular, biblical financial stewardship, which had always been a passion of mine. I mean, my career didn't take me into the financial world. God called me into the ministry, but I wanted to know everything the Bible had to say about money and our relationship to it. It's just part of my wiring. And I remember early on in the interview, he asked me for a definition of financial freedom. I wasn't expecting the question. I really didn't prepare a whole lot for the interview and didn't have, you know, an answer. But what actually rolled off my lips came out like melted butter on a biscuit. I mean, it just flowed so easily. And partly because it was so much a part of my study of the scriptures. It was so much a part of, you know, who I was. It was a part of Catherine and I's marriage and how we set up our financial life. I wasn't ready for the host's response because he says, "I've never heard something like that before." He was so taken back by it. He says, "That is so good." He says, "Can I use it?" I thought he was wanting to steal my material or something like that. But I quickly said, "Sure, my teaching is not my own. This comes after years of studying the scriptures about what God has to say about money and our relationship to it. Use it. Use it to bless other people." So if you've heard this someplace else, it started here, okay? Started from the Lord, but you know, I shared it out there many, many years ago. I want to share with you a fivefold definition of God's plan for your financial freedom and mine. But I'm going to begin with the understanding that God really does want us to be financially free. How many of you want to be financially free, regardless of what your definition is? Yeah, most of us do. We just don't know how to get there. And there's so many financial traps we fall into in our world, even as Christians, unintentionally falling into financial traps. It takes just seconds to get into debt. It takes years to dig yourself out of that kind of debtor's prison. But God has wisdom in His Word. He has given us a repository of biblical and financial wisdom that leads to financial freedom. Let me give you a few verses of Scripture that sort of nail down this idea that God really is in the freedom business. And these verses apply maybe primarily to our salvation, but more broadly to anything that might enslave us and hold us in bondage, even financial bondage. John chapter 8 and verse 32, Jesus Himself said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed." Let me paraphrase it. If you know the truth about money and you put it into practice, it'll set you free. 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 17, "Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom." Galatians 5 and verse 1, "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery." And then in Luke chapter 4 and verse 18, Jesus was in the synagogue. He opens up the scroll of Isaiah. He reads a messianic prophecy, rolls it back up and says, you know, this day this prophecy is fulfilled. But part of that prophecy said, "He sent me to proclaim freedom, freedom for the prisoners." Yeah, we're in bondage to our sin, to our addictions, all of that kind of stuff. And salvation in Jesus Christ sets us free. And keep in mind that the devil is a slave master. He will work overtime to enslave you any way he can, to limit your future and to limit your, you know, capabilities for the Lord and all that. And one of those ways comes from the unintended consequences of poor financial decisions. Either because we didn't learn about these things growing up. You know, financial literacy among this generation is at an all-time low. We used to teach basic budgeting in school. We don't do that anymore. And we're seeing the negative effects of that. Your home, whether you're an individual or a family, your home is like a small business. You have income, you have expenses. Some small businesses go out of business. And in a marriage, in a family, that's called divorce. Financial stress is still the number one reason couples don't make it till death do us part. And I believe God has given us a way to avoid so much of that stress. So I want to ask you today, do you want to be financially free? If you do, say the word freedom.
Freedom.
Now, you got to say it like you really want it.
Freedom.
You got to say it like you cannot live without it.
Freedom.
And you are sick and tired of being sick and tired of being in financial bondage, and you want freedom today. Are you ready for this? All right, here's the fivefold definition. God's plan for your financial freedom. Number one, free of debt. Most financial planners agree that being debt-free is the beginning of any definition of financial freedom. Most of us would probably agree. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 7, which says, listen to this, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is slave to the lender. Think about that. The borrower is slave to the lender. In other words, debt makes you a prisoner of your past. Just let that sink in for a moment. Debt makes you a prisoner of your past. I said it earlier, it takes just seconds to get into debt, to plunk down that credit card and purchase something, or to sign a mortgage obligation that you really shouldn't be signed. It takes seconds to do that. It takes years to dig yourself out of that prison. It makes you a prisoner of your past, and it limits your future. Now, until the mid-19th century, people who could not pay their debts were thrown into what was called debtor's prison throughout most of Western Europe. Debtor's prison was a workhouse where destitute people who could not pay their debt labored until their debt was paid off, or until friends or family could secure outside funds to pay the court-ordered judgment against them. Thankfully, there are not debtor's prisons, you know, around Western Europe or anywhere in the world that I know of today. But make no mistake about it, people who amass large sums of uncontrollable debt have cast themselves into a debtor's prison and locked themselves in financial prison for years. For example, and I did some recent study about where we are in 2023. At the beginning of this year, the average American household had $10,000 in credit card debt, just credit card debt. And these are the people who are getting up in the morning and singing, I off to work I go, all right? They're in debtor's prison. Why? Because assuming an interest rate of, let's just say 15%, and most credit cards are charging 20 up to 23%, it would take 26 years to pay off that $10,000 debt if you make the minimum monthly payment only. And that's exactly what the credit card companies want you to do. Worse yet, again, the interest rates are in the 20s, 23%. Now, in the Bible, uncontrollable debt is not so much a sin as it is an unwise way to live. It is a poor and faithless way to steward the money God has entrusted to you. I say use credit cards. There's nothing moral or immoral about a credit card. It's a tool. Use it to your advantage. Use it only when you have the money already saved up in an account over here so that when the bill comes, you pay it off in full. I'm not bragging when I say this, but I want you to understand it's really possible to do this. In 30 years of marriage, not once have Catherine and I made a minimum monthly credit card payment and rolled the rest of it. Not once. Why? Because we decided before we were married how we were going to manage some of our finances. We use credit cards all day long, but we always pay the bill off 100% when it comes. By the way, the credit card industry calls people like me and you, if you do that, deadbeats. Yeah, they call us deadbeats for doing that. I'll take it all day long. I'm a deadbeat. I take the free 30-day loan and the mileage and the points and the hotel points and all that that go along with it. So credit cards are not a bad thing, but you can fall into a credit card trap. If you use one and say, well, the money's coming down the road somewhere. Oh, boy, that's a dangerous thing. And billions and billions of dollars, almost $200 billion in credit card debt in our country today. Some people, sadly, have kind of grown comfortable in debtor's prison. Yeah, they're making the monthly payment. And, you know, they just kind of assume it's part of life. And they bump it up a little bit more. And they don't realize the limitations it places upon them in the future. Keep in mind that what I'm saying today and achieving financial freedom, about 20% of it is about knowledge. You don't need to be a Wall Street expert. You don't need to be a financial expert. You don't have to have a financial planning degree. 20% of it is knowledge. 80% of it's behavior. And some people have grown comfortable in debtor's prison. And until you get sick and tired and of being in debtor's prison, and you have the full understanding of how it limits your future and your freedom, you won't change. I've seen it too many times. I've counseled with people as a pastor, and you know, we go through their budget and all of that, and we identify some changes that need to be made. They never get around to changing it. And so you have a choice to make today. You can take the knowledge and the wisdom that God gives us in the scriptures, but you need to apply it. There are other financial traps that we fall in, debt traps. One is called the co-signature trap, I call that. The book of Proverbs is a part of the wisdom literature in the Old Testament, and it is chock full of a warning against something called surety. That's co-signing on a loan for somebody else. You might think you're doing them a favor, like your child or another family member, maybe even a stranger who says, hey, I need a little help here. I can't get a loan for my small business from the bank. Would you mind co-signing on this? Run, Forrest, run. Don't ever do that. You'll probably destroy a friendship, if not a family relationship, because if they couldn't get a loan from the bank, there's probably a reason for that. But here's what Proverbs says in chapter 6 and verse 3, and this is just one of the places. My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, having given your pledge for a stranger, if you are snared in the words of your mouth, caught in the words of your mouth, then do this, my son, and save yourself, for you have come into the hand of your neighbor. Go, hasten, and plead urgently with your neighbor to get out of the obligation. Another financial trap that people often fall into debt-wise is the student loan trap. I'm just going to say it. The United States government has enslaved millions of Americans by getting involved in the college loan business. Somebody needs to elect an official who will stop this madness because it's raised college prices. That's where it's all coming from. Because when the government gets involved in something like that, it just creates inflation. And now we have millions and millions of people who are enslaved to their student loans. One other financial trap I'll mention is what I call the mortgage trap. So many Americans have bought more house than they can afford. And you would think that our legislators and others in society and the financial world would have learned something from the 2008 financial crisis. But now the mortgage companies are back to 30, 35, even 40% of debt income ratios to give you a loan. Every time Catherine and I have bought a house or refinanced, you know, the mortgage lender says, you can afford a whole lot more. You know that, right? No, I know that. But we buy less than what we can afford. There are so many people who are house poor. And the definition of house poor is you overbought. And when it comes to Friday night and you wonder whether you can take your wife or your family to Chili's for dinner, no, you can't because the mortgage payments do. And a family vacation is really out of the question. I say keep it, you know, less than 25% in a debt-to-income ratio, and you will be able to breathe financially. So the first is free of debt. Secondly, is free from the love of money. Now, this is a biblical definition, right? You're not going to hear this from the average secular financial planner. But Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5 says, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. Well, there's a novel idea, contentment, delayed gratification. And practicing that, we're not very good at delaying our gratification in anything. And with our access to easy credit, boy, you just plop down that card. Yeah, we'll worry about paying for it later. Now, be content with what you have. Lives that are free from the love of money. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 10 says, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." Yeah, some of them have sat in my pastoral office. And they're just, you know, struggling because of the consequences of unwise financial decisions that have been accelerated by a love for money and what money can buy them. Solomon, the wisest man in the Bible and one of the wealthiest, of course, Ecclesiastes chapter 5, he says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity." Now read those verses carefully. The Bible does not say that money is the root of all kinds of evil. There's nothing wrong with money. Money's a neutral thing. It has no moral value to it. It says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. There's nothing wrong or immoral about having a lot of money. You can have a lot of money as long as money doesn't have you. You know the difference between the two? You can possess things, or things can possess you. Last couple of weeks, we traveled around the ancient world of Greece and Rome and Italy, parts of Turkey. The Greco-Roman world of 2,000 years ago was full of pagan, idolatrous worship. I mean, the ruins of these incredible shrines and temples to these pagan gods, the god of Apollo, the god of Artemis, the god of this, the god of that. Gods made by hands and by stone and decorated beautifully. And we don't live in a world like that today. We kind of, you know, go through the ruins and maybe quietly say, well, we're not quite like that. But our gods are different today. And money and the love of money can easily become our god. And we make financial decisions that get us into all kinds of trouble. If God has entrusted you with much, don't feel guilty about that. Just remember the words of Jesus, "To whom much has been given, much is required." There's a great responsibility that comes with wealth, to be a good steward of what God has entrusted to you. You say, well, I don't have very much. I don't make very much money. But I can tell you that in your lifetime, at least $1 million has passed through your hands. If you make $25,000 a year for 40 years, and most people make more than that, but 25,000 times 40 years, $1 million. $1 million has passed through your hands. What did you do with that? How did you steward that? How did you save, invest, give, and even make that money? And we could go on and on. To whom much has been given, much is required. But these verses tell us that contentment is the antidote to the love of money. Bill Gothard says, "Contentment is realizing that God has already given me everything I need for my present happiness." Are you a content person? A little-known contributor to the Proverbs in the Old Testament is a guy named Agur. You can read his proverb in Proverb chapter 30. And he expresses his contentment this way: "Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread." He says, I don't want to be so poor that I get angry at God because he hasn't provided for me, but I don't want to be so rich that wealth and riches and a love for money draws my heart away from the God that I love. So are you more like a goer, or are you more like the rich young ruler who came in contact with Jesus? Remember that story in the Gospels? He was young. He was very wealthy. He was a ruler. And Jesus had a conversation with him. And at the end of that conversation, he told him this: "Go and sell all that you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." It's the only person in the Bible Jesus said, "Sell it all and give to the poor." Why? Because he was able to, in that conversation, look into that rich young ruler's heart and see that a shrine toward money and the things that money could buy him and all of his wealth, it had become his god. And when a love for money becomes our God, there's nothing short of radical financial surgery to free ourselves of that. Give it away. Just distance yourself from it, Jesus said. All right, so free of debt, free from the love of money. Here's the third thing I said on that radio program, free to give generously. Biblical financial freedom also means I am free to give generously and joyfully and cheerfully and hilariously. In Acts chapter 20, in our study of the Apostle Paul's life and ministry, I think before we went to Greece and for the last couple of weeks, we left him on the island of Miletus. And he was saying farewell to the Ephesian elders. He arrived in Miletus with his team and he says, hey, call the Ephesian elders over. He had served in Ephesus for 3 years, a two-year period of time, broken up by a little time away and then another year. Longest Paul had served anywhere. And it was time to say farewell. He had his sights set on Rome. He was going to stop off in Jerusalem, and there's a whole journey there that we'll explore in the weeks to come. But here's one of the things that he said in that tearful farewell to the Ephesian elders, Acts 20 and verse 35, it is more blessed to give than it is to receive. He's quoting from Jesus. He says, just as our Lord taught us, it is more blessed to give than it is to receive. Do you want to live the blessed life? Most people do. Yeah, Pastor, I want to live the blessed life. Do you want it enough to put this into practice? That you're a giver, not a taker? That you're a steward who's managing the wealth that God has entrusted to you in a, you know, eternal kind of way, but not an owner that says, get your paws off my stuff. And you get all upset when, you know, the preacher talks about money. It's more blessed to give than it is to receive. Could I look inside your financial life, just your checkbook for a moment? And would I see evidence of this truth being put into practice? That the first thing you do with the wealth that God has entrusted to you is to give generously. Are you growing in the grace of giving? You know, in Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, he writes these words. And it's in a section of scripture where he's talking specifically about money and giving. And he uses a farming analogy here. He says, the point is this, whoever sows sparingly reaps sparingly. And whoever sows bountifully or generously reaps generously. He pictures a farmer who has a bag of seed and anticipates a harvest. But this farmer holds on to his seed and only scatters a little bit. And what's going to happen? Well, at harvest time, he's going to be disappointed, because he sowed sparingly. And Jesus applies this specifically to our financial giving. There's no missing his point here. Now, that's not to say, you know, you give a dollar and next week you're going to get a, you know, something in the mail, $2. But biblical economics works this way. Wall Street says the way to build wealth is by buying low and selling high. Biblical economics and Jesus economics is sowing and reaping. You do what seems counterintuitive. You give it away first. And that activates what we call biblical economics, where Jesus says, give, and it shall be given unto you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. The measure with which you give is the measure with which it will be returned to you. Luke 6:38. And, you know, we can say we believe these things and we trust the Lord, but does your financial life reflect your financial trust in the Lord? There's only one way to do that, and that's to put God first in your finances. You can't say he's first in my life if he's last in your budget. It doesn't work that way. He's got to be first. And by the way, nobody is too poor to give generously. Generosity is not about the amount you give, it's about the size of your sacrifice. And that's why Jesus was so impressed that day when he and the disciples went to the temple and they saw this. He saw this widow. He noticed this widow come. And at the temple, they would have an offering receptacle. And the wealthy and the Pharisees loved to come with their coins and pour them into these receptacles. And you would hear the clinking and clanking of the coins. And they'd, you know, sit around waiting for people to look. Well, who poured all of that in? Nobody noticed this widow who came with just two copper coins. She didn't make any noise. But Jesus noticed. And he says to his disciples, did you see what she just did? She gave everything. And the disciples they had no clue. They had no clue. Nobody is too poor to give generously. When Paul was collecting for the poor in Jerusalem, and he's going around to all the churches that he had planted, encouraging them to give, he comes to the Corinthians, he looks at their giving record, it was a goose egg. And so he writes his second letter, chapters 8 and 9 was to address this. And he uses the poor churches in Macedonia, who didn't have two nickels to rub together, they were rural churches. He says they have overflowed with generosity. And I'm paraphrasing, but he basically looks at the Corinthians and says, come on, Corinthians, you can do at least as well as they do. And he encourages them to give. Free to give generously. We should excel as Christians in the grace of giving, Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. Are you more generous today than you were last year? Are you growing in the grace of giving? Coming to the Lord and saying, how much more can we give? Not how much more can we get. How much more can we give this year? So free of debt, free from the love of money, free to give generously. How about this one? Free to have fun. Free to have fun. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 19. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in this toil, this is the gift of God. Now, we would all agree that children are a gift from the Lord, but you know, the wealth that he entrusts to us at whatever level is also a gift from him. And one of the purposes is for us to enjoy what he's entrusted to us. I remember years ago listening to Dave Ramsey talk about a caller who called into his national financial radio program. And the guy says, Dave, I'm struggling with a purchase. He says, I really like motorcycles, and I've always dreamed of owning a Harley Davidson. So I'd really like to buy one, but man, they're kind of up there in price. And so they were talking back and forth a little bit. Finally, Dave just asked him point blank. He says, well, you know, what's your net worth? I mean, what have you got to work with? And the guy stumbles around. He says, I don't know, somewhere around 20 million. You know what Ramsey said? He says, dude, buy the Harley. Buy the Harley, enjoy it. Now make sure that your other financial priorities has put God first. And you're not buying something to enjoy that you should be giving to the Lord. Malachi chapter 3 calls that robbing God. No, we don't want to do that. But when you put God first, and after all your giving is done, yeah, enjoy. Enjoy the gift that God has given to you. So biblical financial freedom, free of debt, free from the love of money, free to give generously, free to have fun. And all of this leads to being free of financial anxiety. Free of financial anxiety. My mind goes to the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, beginning in verse 19. Jesus talks about money. He says, where your treasure is, that's where your heart is also. He says, no one can serve two masters. You can't serve God and money. He says, don't lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust corrupt and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth or rust corrupt and thieves don't break in and steal. And then right after that section of scripture, he talks about worry. I think there's a connection between the two, because the number one thing we worry about and get stressed about is money and finances, right? It's still the number one reason couples end up in divorce, because of just bone-crushing debt and financial stress. And it drives the couple apart. That's why anytime I have an opportunity to do premarital counseling, most premarital counseling curriculums don't ask the money question, or it's real fluffy. Oh no, Catherine and I, we have the money conversation. You know, how do you become one flesh and one financially? How do you get on the same page financially? Do you understand each other's propensities toward making and saving and giving and investing money? Are you on the same page? Because if not, you're gonna come to a point where the stress there and the conflict is so great, and the financial anxiety that you're experiencing is overwhelming. I don't think God wants that for us. And he tells us in that section in the Sermon on the Mount, he talks about worry and how irrational it is to worry about the clothes that you wear and the, you know, food that you eat and the drink. I mean, the basic necessities of life. And then he concludes in verse 34, therefore, don't be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Are you free of financial anxiety? I am here to tell you that if you learn the financial principles that are in the scriptures and follow God's plan, there will be a time when you're free of financial anxiety and you have financial peace. One of my professors in college, financial planning professor, used to say, when it comes to financial planning, you need a plan. And this is what I'm going to leave you with today, is a plan, a starter, to organize your financial life with biblical priorities. Everybody needs a financial plan. Doesn't mean everybody needs to be a finance major. Not everybody needs to be a Wall Street wizard. Not everybody needs to understand everything there is. Remember, 20% knowledge, 80% behavior. But everybody needs a plan. If you fail to plan financially, my professor said, if you fail to plan financially, you plan to fail financially. And that is true. If you're just kind of, you know, going through life thinking it'll all work out, there's a payday coming someday. And it's like hitting your head on a load of bricks. And that's why I want to leave you with a simple financial plan that Catherine and I started our marriage with. Listen, I have biblical authority for all that I'm saying here this morning, but I've got 40 years, listen to this, 40 years of experience, friends. I maybe couldn't speak this with this much conviction when I was 25 years old, because I was still 40 years of doing this. This works. This works because it's God's word. It's the prioritizing of our finances in a biblical way. But everybody needs a plan. And by the way, it's not the ostrich financial plan where you just stick your head in the sand. You know, I know people with that kind of financial planning, and they say things like, well, it'll all work out eventually one day. Or they spiritualize it by saying, God will take care of us. Yeah, God has taken care of us. He's given us wisdom in his word, a lot of it. And he wants us and expects us to apply it into our financial lives. Everybody needs a short-term and a long-term financial plan. Short-term financial plan is called a budget. I know you want to curl up in the corner, in the fetal position when you hear the dreaded B word. But think of a budget as a spending plan where you tell your money what to do and where to go before you wonder where it went. And that's where we end up, you know, at the end of the month or at the end of the year or at the end of a lifetime wondering, where did all this money that passed through my hand, where did it go? And we want to avoid that. Proverbs 27, verses 23 and 24 says, know well the condition of your flocks and give attention to your herds, for riches do not last forever, and does a crown endure to all generations? We don't live in an agrarian society with flocks and herds, but we have bank accounts and savings accounts and investment accounts. Do you know well the condition of your accounts and where the money is? So let me give you just a simple plan. This is a starter. I call it the 10-10-80 plan, all right? Number one, give to God first and start with 10%. It's called a tithe. A tithe is an apportionment, which means a tenth. I don't have time to develop the biblical argument for tithing, but in all of my studies, all over these years, I believe it's the biblical starting point in our giving. If you feel legalistic about it, don't give 10%, okay? Give 11 or 12 or 13, but don't go the other direction. Nobody in the Bible was considered generous that gave less than a tithe. The widow gave everything, you know, as did some others. But give to God first. First. As soon as the money comes in. Don't wait until you paid all the bills. Doesn't take any faith to do that. Don't wait until the end of the year when you know, doesn't take any faith to do that. Proverbs 3, verses 9 and 10 says, honor the Lord with your wealth. How? With the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing and your vats will brim over with new wine. In that agrarian culture, when the harvest came in, they took the first fruits and they put it over here as an offering to the Lord. That was an act of faith, an act of faith. And likewise, we give to God first. Secondly, you pay yourself. I say that's the second 10%. The first one establishes your eternal portfolio. Remember, Jesus said, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. I call that sanctified self-interest. He says, do this for yourself. Why? Because you have an account in heaven, child of God. And we're encouraged to lay something else, to lay something up there. You can't take it with you, but you can send it ahead, right? That's your eternal portfolio. But you need an earthly portfolio as well. That's why after you give to God first, you pay yourself second. That's called savings and investments. And you need two kinds of savings or investment accounts. One is an emergency fund. I call it the life happens fund. The car breaks down, the washer and dryer break down. About a month ago, Catherine and I noticed a leak in the roof of our house. We brought the roofer out. The first bid was $2,500. Always good to get a second bid because the second was about $700, but still a lot of money. Nobody likes to pay that, but we have an emergency account over here, okay? I say it needs to be 3 to 6 months worth of your expenses, okay? That's a good place to be. And it may take a while to get there, but you need a highly liquid, life happens, emergency, because you don't know what's gonna happen down the road. And what happens to a lot of people is they're living paycheck to paycheck. They're just, you know, like a gerbil trying to keep ahead here, and then life happens, oh, put it on a credit card. $2,500 or $700 or whatever it is, and it just piles up over time. So the first thing to establish is your emergency savings. The second thing is your extended savings. Some people call it retirement savings. I don't like the word retirement. I plan on working until my mind doesn't work or my body doesn't work. I'm called to preach the gospel until my last breath. But there comes a time for all of us where we maybe outlive our primary earning years and income years. Since I was 22 years old, first job out of college, when the HR team came to us new employees and said, we have a 401k account established for you, and here's how it works. I've been shoveling 10%, the maximum I can, into that since I was 22 years old. The Bible way to build wealth is little by little over a long period of time. You say, well, I don't have 30 or 40 years. Start now. Start now. My dad is 89 years old. If I live that long, all right, I've got another 30 years. Will I have the kind of investments that will extend to the rest of my life and take care of my family? Those are the savings you're going to have to do. Give to God first. Activate biblical economics. Get God on the side of your finances. And believe me, he can make 90% or, you know, 88% or whatever, go a whole lot further than you and I can make 100% go. I've just seen it, you know, over the years, how faithful he is when we honor him with our wealth. Pay yourself second. And all of this presupposes delayed gratification, okay? Your eternal portfolio is the ultimate in delayed gratification. You're laying it up for yourselves in heaven. You won't see it. You won't see the benefit of it until you get to heaven. Okay? And then to get yourself in a healthy savings position, you're going to have to lower your standard of living to at least 80% of your income and maybe less than that. If you haven't been doing this for a while, you've got to adjust some of these figures. Never adjust your giving downward. Try to excel in the grace of giving, but maybe you need to come up to 15% or 20% to accelerate that extended savings for a period of time, which means you need to lower your standard of living. Maybe you're in a house too expensive, or you got expensive car payments. You got to make some tough decisions in order to get healthy financially and experience financial peace and all the freedom that we've been talking about here. According to the latest polls, 63% of Americans have less than $500 in the bank. Ill-prepared for the next emergency, let alone for the future that is coming. And then number three, you live off the rest. Now, it's a starting point, 10, 10, 80. Catherine and I have always tried to increase the first number. God, how much more can we give this year? And when opportunities come along to, you know, we want to respond to that. We've stayed on a savings plan all these years, little by little over a long period of time. Compound interest in time is your best friend. It's not about timing the stock market. It's about time in the market. And you just ride the ups and downs, okay? Don't try to time it. No, no, even the timing guys out there can't time the market. Just stay in. And little by little over a long period of time, it builds up. That's the Bible way to build wealth. Get rich quick schemes, Proverbs says, no, don't do that. All right? But start where you are, 10, 10, 80. And if you're a young family or a young person, if you're thinking about getting married, boy, have this conversation with your fiance. And start your marriage debt-free and committed to pursuing God's plan for your financial freedom. And you will be blessed. You will be stress-free because you're doing it God's way. And honoring Him first and watching Him make up for all the silly decisions you make along the way. And Catherine and I have made a number of them. But this is God's plan for your financial freedom and for mine. And I pray that you take it to heart, put it into practice. Do the things you need to do today to order your finances in a biblical way and begin experiencing the freedom that God wants for every one of us.